Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. In this episode, we speak with Darren Touch, founder and CEO of the Canada-China Forum, as he discusses his interest in international relations with China and his experience as a Schwarzman Scholar at Tsinghua University. He shares his insights on the current state of Canada-China relations and the necessary steps to strengthen the relationship. Darren emphasizes the importance of people-to-people exchanges, educational programs, and the language proficiency in building a new generation of leaders well-versed in China affairs. He also highlights the challenges of binary thinking and the opportunities for Canadians to gain hands-on experience in China and other parts of the world. Enjoy.
The relationship now, it's better than it was before. You know, what was very positive about the Canada-China relationship is Minister Zhou Li visited Beijing in July and met with Wang. That was the first time for our foreign minister to have visited in a couple of years since the relationship was frozen. And so that was an opening. We've worked with China on a number of different fronts, especially on biodiversity. And so we're seeing these areas emerge. However, behind the rhetoric of let's cooperate with China on the environment and biodiversity, let's work with them on nuclear proliferation or narcotics. I think we need to see the substance behind that. What is, where are we going? We've talked about working together, cooperating with each other on these issues, but let's see the programs.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Darren, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
So, where are you in the world that we're recording you from today?
Todd, I'm sitting in the beautiful province of Alberta, in the city of Calgary. But I wish I was in other places, actually. I wish I was in either Beijing with my friends at the Schwarzman College or Shanghai. It's been a while since I've been back there.
You and me both. It has been some time, and I am definitely itching to get back and have some Dongbei Cai. I miss it. I try to recreate some dishes over here that I really miss, and it always goes poorly.
Ingredients. You need to have the ingredients in a way, and sometimes it's just hard to access, right?
It is very much. So let's start by having you share your interest in international relations, particularly with China. Where did this all first begin?
Look, this all first began for me as a student sitting in a classroom in grade 6 in Alberta. We had to learn about China as a part of our curriculum. However, the China back then in grade 6 was 2006, right? And so I opened this book, and what do I see? I see bikes, just a lot of people on bikes biking through Beijing. And that was a notion of what we thought China was at that point. 2008 comes along, it's the Beijing Olympics, and it sends a very different picture for me, right? So that was my first exposure there. I knew I wanted to pursue somewhat of a career associated or near China. When I was at the University of Ottawa studying policy, I realized that Canada wasn't thinking much about China. I myself, I'm Cambodian-Canadian here. And so I've been very familiar with the region per se, but knew China was just important, right? You could see that during the Beijing Olympics. However, we weren't thinking about China as a country in the nation's capital. And so I pursued an internship at the Canadian Embassy in Beijing. I was in the political section and spent a few months there, just kind of absorbing what it was like to be on the ground. Beijing in 2015 was very different. It was polluted in a way. We were still using cash at that point, which is surprising now because when you go to China, it's very much a cashless society. And so that's surprising here because at home in Canada, we still use cash.
100%. We used to joke, like when I lived in China, like you'd wash your jeans and forget you had some cash in your bag, and it would stain the back pocket of your pants because cash would sit in there for so long. All right. I want to get because you are a Schwarzman scholar.
at Tsinghua University.
That's right.
That is something. That is something. You're an intelligent guy or a hardworking guy or both, probably. And we've had Schwarzman Scholars on before. We've had a couple before in the 5+ years that we've been doing the podcast. Tell us a little bit about what it means to be a Schwarzman Scholar, first of all. And then how did this experience deepen your understanding of China's role on the global stage?
Look, I think to be a Schwarzman Scholar, there was a desire to bridge East and West. It's the essence of why the program was created. You know, there are differences in the world. There are differences in opinions on issues, on a wider range of things here, right? But there needs to be kind of a mutual understanding of where people are coming from. And so that's why Steve created this program, to create opportunities for the West to understand the East, but also for the East to understand the West. As a Canadian in the program, it was an opportunity for me to return back to Beijing in 2019. So I was there 2015 once. But China was vastly different by this point, right? As I mentioned, we weren't using cash anymore. Technology was just everywhere. You know, you could pay with your face, for example, and that was just new to me. But being in the program was a great opportunity to study at one of China's top universities, Tsinghua University. It's ranked number one. You know, for a nation of 1.4 billion people, that's impressive. That's, you know, people rate the Gaokao just to get into the university. You know, the top tier, the creme de la creme of China goes to that university. So you're surrounded by incredible talent, intellect, but it also teaches you about leadership. You know, how do you navigate issues where there are major disagreements? And I think the vision is where in the future there could be disagreements, but on one side of the table, there's a Schwarzman Scholar, and on the other side is yourself. And you could be, you know, you could have those conversations in a very candid way. I think the opportunities to study in China are becoming far and few. And so this is one of the critical programs out there that continues to exist. You know, I think we're welcoming the 9th cohort now to be able to learn about China in an immersive way.
For those who may not know, the Gaokao is similar to the SATs, right? So this is your post-high school kind of entrance exam and measurement stick that is extremely important to determine what level of school that you get into for university, just for everybody so that you know.
And extremely challenging, by the way, too, right?
So. Yes. Yeah, it's no joke. Absolutely. I want to talk, and we're going to get into all of this, but you are the founder and CEO of the Canada-China Forum. Now, let's start with what motivated you to start the organization, and then tell us what are its primary goals.
Okay, I left Schwarzman College kind of in the midst of the pandemic. We went online and returned back to Canada, and I remember thinking, who are the other Canadians that I can connect with, you know, on China? Who are the other Canadians that are interested in learning and building their China competencies? And we're such a large country in Canada, if you think about it, right? And these communities are hard to maintain and build, especially if you don't live in the same geographical region. But the pandemic really changed that. We jumped online, so we started as a virtual organization. And when you add kind of the membership and folks you joined from Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, you become a considerable group. And so we're now more than 100 members from coast to coast to coast. Some of our members are abroad. Some of our members are actually in Beijing, London, DC at the moment. But it's an opportunity to really put a Canadian lens as to how do we, you know, manage our relationship with China, whether it's political, our economic relations, our environmental relations, you name it. It's our ability to really take stock as to where we are at as a country, right? And create space for people to engage on these issues that are so pertinent towards where we're going.
Considering your experience, your extensive experience in public policy, and you might want to catch us up a little bit on that. I know you spent some time in Washington as well. So maybe catch us up just a little bit on what that experience entails. And then, and hopefully this isn't too much to remember, how do you assess the current state of the Canada-China relations? And what steps do you believe are necessary to strengthen this relationship? So if you only get to one or two, I will come back with a third. But talk to us a little bit about your experience in public policy. And then how are you assessing the current state of the Canada-China relations?
Happy to chat through. So, you know, I first heard it out at the Public Policy Forum. It's a national think tank in Ottawa that thought about a lot of Canadian issues. And there I was thinking about, okay, where is the China angle to a lot of this, right? That made me pursue to want to become a Schwarzman Scholar. So then went to Beijing, came back, was hit with the pandemic. I was given an opportunity to pursue a fellowship at the Wilson Center. It's a think tank based in DC with the Kissinger Institute and the Canada Institute. And there I was looking at how can Canada navigate our relationship with China and the United States. You know, where are the areas of alignment? Where are the areas of, you know, misalignment in this case? Because the United States was pursuing its own Indo-Pacific strategy. At that time, Canada had no Indo-Pacific strategy. We didn't have a strategy really on China. We had a whole bunch of speeches from the minister, kind of a declaration of where things might go. But there was no clear strategy to where our relationship with the region was going. And, you know, this was at the time of, you know, the detainment of Michael Kovrig, Michael Spavor, and Meng Wanzhou here in Canada. So our relationship was at an all-time low. You know, some would characterize it as being frozen, which is, to be honest, very true, because there was not much, you know, going on. For those who were very optimistic about the bilateral relationship, you know, they were seeing just... It was just going awry in this case, where there was not much movement at all fronts here. And the domestic pressure and domestic attitude was highly negative. And I think it still is to an extent, right? If you think about some of the issues confronting our bilateral relationship. So I was at the Wilson Center examining these issues, talking to the expert, and was ultimately invited by Minister Jolie to sit on her Indo-Pacific Advisory Committee. And so there I was able to provide a unique perspective as to how do we build and sustain the next generation of Canadians who can engage with the Indo-Pacific region, understand China, understand Southeast Asia in this case, right? It's important to, you know, think about our considerations now. Yes, the economy, trade is very important. But for those to sustain the economy and trade that we have with the region, it's really the people, right? It's people like you and I who've had hands-on experience living, working in China or the region in this case. We need to see more of that. And so that makes me think about what can we do? You know, it's the education system here where what are the exchanges looking like? What are the internships looking like for Canadians to study and work abroad in the region in China in this case? And so that experience was paramount, and it led me to kind of continue to advocate for more opportunities for young Canadians to study, work, and live in the region, because that's the only way that we're going to sustain our relationship in the long term.
Yeah. Where's that relationship now? Just real quick.
Look, I think the relationship now, it's better than it was before. You know, what was very positive about the Canada-China relationship is Minister Jolie visited Beijing in July and met with Wang Yi. Right? That was the first time for our foreign minister to have visited in a couple of years since the relationship was frozen. And so that was an opening. We've worked with China on a number of different fronts, especially on biodiversity. And so we're seeing these areas emerge. However, behind the rhetoric of let's cooperate with China on the environment and biodiversity, let's talk about, you know, let's work with them on nuclear proliferation or narcotics. I think we need to see the substance behind that. What is, you know, where are we going? We've talked about working together, cooperating with each other on these issues, but let's see the programs. Right. And so that's where I hope to see more action. But behind the scenes, we're also seeing trade. A lot of Canadian businesses and brands continue to do well, but we're not hearing about them. Right. You're talking about Lululemon, Arc'teryx, Tim Hortons. You know, those businesses are growing at a rapid rate. One of the surprising things was there was never a Tim Hortons when I was in Beijing in 2019. There is one in Shanghai, but apparently now there are tons. You know, that's incredible to hear. But that success story is one that we don't often hear about.
Tim Hortons is not necessarily...
You're right on that front.
I hate myself for doing it.
It's an iconic brand, and there is nuances to this. But if you're a store that's going to put up a maple leaf, you know, it's like little headquarters of Canada, right?
It's
done well despite the bilateral relationship. The maple leaf is still associated with Canada. And it's surprising to me that it's done as well as it has. Right. Yeah. So it goes to show that certain Canadian brands, and, you know, Jacob Cook would also say the same thing, that our Canadian brand continues to do well in China, especially anything to do with wellness or just quality for that matter.
Yeah.
And that's incredibly impressive. Right. So, you know, I wouldn't discount the opportunities the Chinese market still holds for Canadian brands, but I do think there's more that could be done at the people to people level. Right. And I know there are areas of concerns in terms of IP. But for students and researchers to study and, you know, research in China, that should be an area of non-concern at all. especially if you're doing languages or cultural exchange programs. You know, these are the areas that I think we can find agreements in versus disagreement.
For those curious, if you want to go deep dive into that Tim Hortons comment, I believe it's owned by the Burger King Wendy's group. And there's a fun little story about tax avoidance in the U.S. Of kind of how all that went down. However, I digress. It is really interesting. And I want to maybe just touch on the trip that was made where we, you know, kind of went over there and met with them. I always am a little bit curious about how fundamental that is. It's a little, I do perceive it sometimes as a little bit of a smoke show sometimes. Cause like you said, what really came out of it, what fundamentally actually happens, is this just for pictures and media, or is there actual fundamental relationship growth that happens? And maybe that is maybe not between the two of them, where a phone call couldn't suffice. But I think that media, that exposure to the effort, is where at a grassroots level amongst us netizens and citizens of Canada, that's where the actual growth happens in a relationship. Your thoughts?
Look, I think pictures are important in this case, right? It's important for China. It's important for us. The image before was one where at a high level, our governments weren't talking. And so this illustrates that there are conversations to be had, right? If you think about on China's side, we were an irritant. You know, so why invite our foreign minister if we've been so much of a thorn in their side? You just don't invite them to your home. In this case, you know, Melanesia Lee was able to go there, sit across, have the discussions about areas of cooperation, areas of disagreements, whether it's foreign interference or human rights. But it showed, it signaled more than anything else, that there was a willingness on both sides to hopefully turn a new chapter. Whatever that chapter looks like, it's not going to be the same as it was before. There is no, you know, we're not going to go back to 2015 where we were so excited about this relationship. But there is a need to have this relationship, and there's an understanding of the role that China plays in the world. Right. And so, you know, one could say that we were a little late to the game. The United States have had several secretaries visit. There's been state visits with our partners in Europe and the EU. They've gone and had conversation. But it's better to have dialogue than no dialogue in this case. Right. So, Todd, I don't know if a phone call would suffice, or meeting on the sidelines of some international conference is great. But I think our foreign minister is doing exactly what a foreign minister should do. And that's engaging in dialogue to better understand the other's position. Now, we may not expect the prime minister to visit. You know, let's not expect that. But a foreign minister, that should be expected in this case.
Your thoughts and opinions, and you can disclaimer that all you want as just your own. But what steps do you believe are necessary to strengthen the relationship?
Okay, I think let's start with people to people. From my perspective, I think you can easily strike that as a low-hanging fruit, you know, expand the number of flights between China and Canada in this case. I know there's been a limitation on that front, or COVID has impacted that at least. The other is educational programs. I think our universities and colleges can definitely start to expand, you know, student exchanges. Research is still a little sensitive, but there are areas of non-sensitive collaborations that we can definitely pursue there, right? So I think those two areas, enhancing the number of flights between the two countries and expanding on educational programs, are just an easy win for both sides.
The Canada-China Forum ostensibly aims to cultivate a new generation of leaders who are also well-versed in China affairs, which is increasingly important as China becomes one of the most prominent countries and cultures in the world. What are some of the key competencies you believe are going to be crucial for these future leaders with respect to China?
And just, you know, just to note, our membership comes from an array of backgrounds. Some of them are in the NGO sector. Some of them are in business, our lawyers, our policymakers. So there's an array of kind of different backgrounds. And you know, the emphasis here is that whatever job that you may have, you should always have a China lens to that, right? And so although we may not have, we not, you know, have educational programs in China per se, where our members are actively living or working there, I view us as an entry point for them to build upon their curiosity, their interest, and maybe hopefully one day gain some hands-on experience in the country. But some areas of competencies, just back to that point, where I think, you know, what we're trying to do is one, establish a baseline knowledge in China's culture and history. The second is understanding modern day China. And so those two areas, we've hosted a number of programs, both virtually and in person, where we bring in experts to share their expertise with this, you know, with this group, right? I think the harder part now is what I would say building competencies in language and experience on the ground, right? Language is you, I'm not sure if you speak Mandarin or not, but I struggle, you know, it's a very hard language. It's very tonal. I have my expressions. I can have superficial conversations, but it takes you a long time to become very fluent in it, right? And however, it will positively impact your understanding of the country, of the region, in a vast way. And then the other is experience. It's finding the experience to study in China, to work in China, to live in China. After the pandemic, you know, as I mentioned before, it was increasingly hard to get to China in the first place. Nowadays, it's becoming increasingly challenging for folks to find work opportunities there, looking for different programs to study in China. And there's just a concern about safety as well, right, that people are having now, which for some, I would say you would just have to take that stock yourself.
Yeah, I haven't been there in a while. But it was incredibly safe while I was there.
Oh, I agree. In 2019, it was incredibly safe.
Yeah. Pickpocketing, some things like this. Yeah, that happens. But as far as physical safety, I always found it to be incredibly safe. Like, you just never saw fights or brawls, even if you went out to bars or clubs and things like that. It was very, very, very rare. I didn't see too much. You may have a couple of taxi drivers, you know, arguing over who was supposed to go first in an alley. But, you know, very, very little. For those, you know, you asked me about my Mandarin ability. This is probably the best statement I can say, you know.
I can say 我说我一点点，or一点点，from Beijing, with a Beijing accent there.
Can you share some insights into some of the challenge opportunity? I feel like I've approached this podcast almost with like a SWOT analysis analogy, you know, strengths and weaknesses, opportunities, threats. Can you maybe just speak to some of the challenges and opportunities? You can start with whichever one you like, that you've encountered while advocating for a balanced and informed approach to Canada's strategy towards China.
I think the challenges in starting this organization, but also kind of advocating to that point of ensuring that we're having nuanced conversation, is that sometimes on this side of the ocean in this country, the way we look at China is very binary, good or bad. Democracy versus authoritarianism, right? I think those binaries aren't helpful for contextualizing a country that has had a, you know, vast histories of hundreds and thousands of years, a rich culture. It's more complex than that. And so I think that continues to be a challenge, is how do we shore up the China knowledge of folks in Canada and the United States to understand that we're not dealing with just an easygoing, we're not dealing with a simple country here. As Canada is not simple in itself, right? Canada is very complex in its history and values, and so I think we should you know, offer the same kind of courtesy that we wish others would kind of, you know, bestow upon us here in that case. That continues to be a major challenge. I think the state of the relationship is a challenge for us, but here's the opportunity, and here's what I've seen as kind of a shimmering light of hope, is that there continues to be a demographic amongst young Canadians who are still keen and eager to learn about China, to want to work in China, to want to live in China, despite where the relationship has been for the last 5 years, right? Because it's been very negative, as I've mentioned before. And if you know, if you're just anyone, you would say, oh, I don't know why I should invest or think about moving to this part of the world. But there continues to be. And I think that has been a point of reassurance where there is a need. And there are people who get that a global China has consequences, has ramifications for Canada And it would be foolish if we weren't investing in learning about, you know, a country that is increasingly complex and interconnected in terms of all facets of the way we think about how the world works, whether it's trade, whether it's the migration of people, international crises. China continues to be fundamental to those equations, right? You can't think of any issue in the world where China is, or you can't put a direct line or a dotted line, at least, to China and Beijing in that case. And so by getting more Canadians to understand that, I think that will position Canada to be much more, strategic in how we engage with the world.
Opportunities that you're seeing that we should be taking more advantage of that are occurring today.
Like, I think the opportunities here, what we could do more of, as I've mentioned, are the educational programs to get more Canadians hands-on experience with that. But it doesn't have to be China. I think Canadians need to leave our lovely North America, and I mean, really moving to other parts of the world to gain that hands-on experience. But there are other ways. There are other forms of governments. There are other forms of the way economies work and industries, and to really bring the best facets back home to Canada, but also share what we do well here, with that part of the world as well. Right? I don't think there is a perfect country in the world. I think everyone has their experiences that are based on their values and history and the way that they have come about to organizing themselves. But, I think there is a need for us to move beyond that. And I think that is the area of opportunities, is how do we create a global Canada in that case, right? By ensuring that these opportunities are actually embedded in our education system. I'm going to talk about, if I learned about China in grade 6 and that was a starting point, imagine the, building pipelines where students can go and study and work at an earlier point in their life and be able to bring that back home, right?
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much. Now, lastly, as someone deeply engaged in community and building community and public affairs, what advice would you have for our young professionals that are aspiring to make a difference in international policy or diplomacy?
I think first off here, I think it's important to leave our comfort zone.
To leave the nest,
to fly out. I left my nest at 18 and we moved away from Calgary to Ottawa, and then from there went to China, right? And so maybe it's not your province or city or state here, but I would encourage you, if you want to make an impact in the world, it's important to go to other parts of the world to understand what the challenges and opportunities are over there. I went to China. It doesn't have to be China. It could be anywhere in the world. And I think that will add tremendous value to your career and will challenge how you think about not only your own norms, values, perspective, but it will also allow you to grow and see how they view the world and what you could bring back here. Right? And so I think leaving the nest is crucial. I think challenging yourself in that sense will allow you to put you on that career path to making a difference. In a way, I think my experience of living in Beijing and DC was one of the reasons why I was invited by Minister Jolie to sit on her advisory council. It was just like, you're one young Canadian that's lived in two parts of the world, and you can kind of see how things move on the ground. That brings a unique perspective, and I think it did. I think I see how Americans think, and I see how Chinese folks think or see issues in the world, and I think that is tremendously valuable. Case, right? I think there's no, you can't quantify that, those experiences at all.
Yeah.
And Todd, you moved around the world, so.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I've often been asked and been told, like, they hear my stories and everything I've been through, and like, wow, you must have learned so much. And my reply is mostly, it's not what I learned, it's what I unlearned. And I think you don't even know you have bias until you start to let it go, and then you realize you actually had it. So without being able to really know what you need to unlearn or let go, you just have to challenge. You just have to get up and go, and you have to live. You have to know what it's like.
You have to be uncomfortable, right? You have to learn to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You have to learn to be in those situations.
Agreed. And it just teaches you so much. And that was one of the great things about, I spent 5 years in Dalian, which was very Chinese, not as international, 6 million people, but not a lot of foreigners. And then moving to Shanghai and holy cow, a ton of foreigners, but from everywhere else. I mean, some of my best friends were from Malaysia or from Denmark or for, you know, South Africa and Mexico, and just spending so much time and our kids all playing together and doing dinner parties together and those kind of things, and just becoming some of my best friends and just learning more about them, their culture, their speech, their parenting styles. It was whatever. And yeah, I just encourage everybody, have strong opinions, but loosely held, and, you know, to go and experience. And I think that is really the best advice. And that's what we need more and more people to do, encourage you to just get out. Always welcome. I've come full circle. I now live back in this town in BC that I was born in, but I am not anywhere near the same person I was when I left. And that's really the more important thing.
And just from a policy point of view, where you're thinking Canada is a country of 40 million people, you know, and how do you manage and think of all the issues confronting Canada at the moment, affordability, housing. Now imagine China, 1.4 billion people, right? There are cities, the population of our country. In that sense, and how do they run programs? How do they address certain issues and concerns? And so you just, sometimes it's just so vastly different that we just can't compare. And so, as you mentioned, Todd, you might be happier living in the People's Republic because of certain reasons. I think the government does respond to certain issues that the citizens has, right? Whether it's the healthcare system, the education system, or a certain standard of living that differs in terms of our values here. So I would say that each country has different values, and you know, that those experiences of living on the ground really opened me up to seeing those perspectives.
Agreed. All right. Darren Touch, founder and CEO of the Canada-China Forum. Thank you very much for being on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Todd. It was a pleasure joining.
Okay. So for everybody who is watching the video on our YouTube channel over at WPIC, don't forget, if you need your eyes or your hands for other things, you can always go listen to the podcast on any of your favorite podcast platforms. And if you're listening to the podcast audio only, don't forget to head over to the WPIC website and catch us on our YouTube channel over there. But from me and from Darren and from everybody at the Negotiation Podcast team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.